We begin the hour by welcoming back our friend Colin Fleming to join us. Good afternoon, Colin.
What is up, Chilly Willy?
Well, you know, we're doing what we do. I got my power back, as you know, from the Facebooks there, and I have to say, yes, I'm a hearty soul. We can pioneer for a while, but I prefer the power. I prefer the heat and the refrigeration.
I think I might have thought you were a little heartier. Maybe I oversold in your mind.
You did.
In my mind, your heartiness. I thought, like, Kimbo, he's like a Munson. And a Munson would sleep with the windows open because he would look out into the darkness and he'd think, you know what, cold? You're not going to get me. I am inured to frostbite. Not going to bother me. And I thought of you coming out of that shower. That still worked, right? Dropping your towel, shaking your fist into the main night, right? I thought, it's a weird thing for me to be thinking, but I'm alone a lot. My thought, sometimes by clarity, right? There it was. I had to peep. I swallowed it. And I thought, time for bed. Kimbo will be fine.
Well, it's all an act. I'm a weak little man, though I did take a cold shower on, what was it, Sunday morning, I think, just because I needed to. I didn't care. I needed some level of cleanliness. So there was that, but that's about as tough as I get, sadly.
I figure a guy like you, you're a popular man, you've lots of friends. No one could let him do the use of a shower?
Well, you know, the social physical distancing thing, although there were people who offered assistance along the way, but see, that's the area I'm too stubborn to take help. So if that counts for something, I've got that going for me.
Yeah, well, I'm sure your germs and everything else you have going on are probably powerful antibiotics, and you'll outlive us all, Kimball.
Well, we'll see what happens there. But, a lot to talk about today. And let's start with it's one of my favorite films, though it's not perfect. It may be flawed, but I do love, from 1946, Orson Welles' The Stranger.
It is very flawed. In fact, I watched it again. It's on the Criterion channel, that app thingy. Right now, if anyone wants to check it out, although it's not hard to check it out, it seems like it's always been available for free, this kind of like dodgy licensing sort of deal where you can just track it down whenever you want. And it was the, I don't even know if you want to call it, the comeback picture for Orson Welles. He had made a film in 3 years after Citizen Kane. It tanked commercially, and then he did Ambersons, and that tanked commercially too, and it didn't get the notices that Kane did, and he was just considered bad box office juju, and he ends up at this different company, even though the distribution was still RKO, and he gets this kind of, he's not the first choice, but he gets this sort of last chance, a bunch of last chances, to make this film under budget and on time. And if he didn't deliver on that, I was reading through the contract, it really would have sucked for him. Like, he was on the hook for a lot. And to babysit Orson Welles, the studio put on it this editor. And the editor, really backwards, had final say on what would be included in the film. So the editor was kind of the director, and Orson Welles worked for the editor. And the editor had this belief. And you see this sometimes, too, in the fiction world, that if something did not contribute directly to advancing the plot, it had to come out. Now, that's not how life is. And Welles said correctly that a lot of the best parts in his film didn't advance the plot. And even some of the best parts in films he was in that he didn't direct. Think about, like, The Third Man. The whole thing with the cuckoo clock, right, when he's in the sewer and that little speech, that doesn't advance the plot, but it's one of the most memorable moments in mid-20th century. No, I mean, really, any cinema that's ever been. So what Welles did was he shot with Russell Meddy, who was going to work later on Touch of Evil. This is a guy who knew his stuff. And he made it so it was very difficult to edit the film. And the way you do that is you do long takes. So we see people inside, like, the pharmacy in the New England town that's been in Connecticut. You see people sitting in the pharmacy playing checkers, walk out into the street, see people in the woods, all these unbroken takes because you can't monkey around with a continuous take.
I was surprised to learn, and as many times as I've seen the film, I didn't know that the original plan was for John Huston to direct.
It was, and he was the top attraction that the studio wanted. And also Wells, too, he wanted some really creative things with this. He wanted Agnes Moorehead to be the character who is on the heels of, people don't know the plot, it's after World War II, the picture's from 1946. And in fact, it features the first ever use of documentary footage of the Nazi death camps. So like you're making your commercial comeback. It's like, I know. I will have a backhoe shoveling bodies into a pit in the ground. And it's like, okay, Orson Welles. And so you have this, Welles plays this Nazi. He is teaching at this school modeled on Welles' own prep school, sitting in Connecticut, though. And he has a different identity, and they are trying to catch him. The U.S. government is trying to catch him and identify who he is, because they think he's not just a Nazi. He is the guy who taught Hitler at his heel, who came up with the whole, you know what we should do? We should have some concentration camps set up. But he wanted Agnes Moorehead to be this spinster who is trying to chase down, well, him, the bad guy, played by Orson Welles. And that was not going to fly. But if you know Agnes Moorehead's work, it would have been a great idea.
Oh, yeah.
How she would have pulled that off. Talk about, like, gender and genre busting.
The film was one of the few that made money. It was a commercial success for Welles, but it's got some issues. I'm not thrilled with the job that Loretta Young does in the movie. What do you see as the weaknesses in it?
Loretta Young doesn't really work, but what's interesting about Welles' films, once you know that they're flawed, like The Lady from Shanghai is this way, and I was watching that too, you can enjoy them a lot more once you know what happened, right? That's kind of a strange thing to say about somebody's film. I don't really know if I could say that about anybody else. But like, for instance, there's this moment, and they have them too, in Stranger, but there's this moment in The Lady from Shanghai where the Grimsby character sees early on the Welles character with the Irish accent kissing his actual wife, who plays the femme fatale in the movie. And it's like so obvious that they don't have to kiss in front of this guy on this boat. And he catches them. And they're like, oh, no, now he's found out about us. It's like, well, you did it right in front of him. It's obviously an edit gone wrong, right? Like, there's something missing. There's footage actually missing. And if you don't know that when you watch it, it doesn't work, and it takes you right out of the movie. But when you know it's there, you kind of watch around it. And so in The Stranger, you get this look of crazed sort of demon quality in Welles' eyes. Like, he has a 500-yard stare going throughout the film a
yes.
lot. You know what I mean?
Where, oh, yeah.
He's looking, he's like, I hear you. Like, he's like, you could put your hand in front of his face and he's so locked in on his, like, Aryan hate that he can't register and react, and it's a really strange kind of performance. But then you have, I always look this up, I know it, but I look it up to confirm, they nail a New England town, don't you think? That's exactly what a New England town
looks
like then.
Yes.
And in our New England towns now, there's still that infrastructure of the Village Green. It was all on a Hollywood backlot. But it looks exactly like a New England town does. I think it captures what New England feels like better than maybe any film I've ever seen. The Trouble with Harry by Hitchcock is another one that really captures New England. But that could be your town, right? Up there.
Yeah, yeah.
It could be my town that I grew up next to Foxborough. So there's strengths, there are weaknesses. And he had this contract where they said, look, you deliver on this, you can do four pictures. They get the cut of the film, right? Even though he didn't have any say over it. And they said, this isn't going to make any money. And they totally reneged on, he thought he was back. He was going to get to make some more movies. And they see this film, and they said, this isn't going to make enough money to justify having this guy around. And they tossed him to the curb.
Talking about The Stranger from Orson Welles. And let's move on. And back about 20 years to one of the great works of, I would say, the entire 20th century, T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland.
Yes, and this is, as everybody knows, April, the cruelest month.
Yes.
Maybe it is a bit more cruel with the economy right now and other factors. But yes, Eliot, and I think it's interesting, too, to talk about now because Dylan, and I want to write about it. I have to find the venue. Dylan had that song come out recently he had it lying around. It's not like he decided, oh, I'm inspired. It's quarantining time. I'm going to do a new song. That's a 17-minute song called Murder Most Foul. And Elliot makes me think of Dylan and vice versa, because they do this mix, and I like it. I suppose I do it too, of the highbrow and the lowbrow. And I think when you're someone who does a mix of the highbrow and the lowbrow, and that's certainly what The Wasteland is, you're not even really interested in respective brows. You're just interested in things that are interesting. And when you are interested in the highbrow and the lowbrow, you tend to be somebody who is not very pretentious, who knows a lot more about a lot more stuff than other people, who filters more viewpoints through your own viewpoint, and who can see the world in really sagacious ways that's helpful for the rest of us. And The Wasteland is like that. So if you think, oh, man, I can't believe these two guys are discussing poetry. I hate poetry. I hate school. Down with that all. Well, if you read The Wasteland, very conversational, very accessible. Another thing you might liken it to is Strawberry Fields Forever. The way that, and I know, I think I am, oh, yes, I mean, all that sort of conversational vernacular is something that we see in this poem about the death of culture by Eliot that ultimately ropes in a lot of references and even cartoons some of those references, like Dylan does in Desolation Row. He has Casanova in Desolation Row, right? He's doing all this, and there's Ophelia, and she sucks, and she's approved, and like all of that stuff. But we have a lot of that going on in The Wasteland, and I was looking at it as I was about to come on, and this part is not long, but note how guttingly conversational it is. And when I get to the end, you're going to hear a reference to something called Shakespearean Rag, which was like a song, like a pop song, like the Justin Bieber of its time. My nerves are bad tonight. Yes, bad. Stay with me. Speak to me. Why do you never speak? Speak. What are you thinking of? What thinking? What? I never know what you are thinking. Think. I think we were in Rats' Alley, where the dead men lost their bone. What is that noise? The wind under the door. What is that noise now? What is the wind doing? Nothing again, nothing. Do you know nothing? Do you see nothing? Do you remember nothing? I remember those are pearls that were his eyes. Are you alive or not? Is there nothing in your head? But oh, 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 that Shakespearean rag, it's so elegant, so intelligent. What shall I do now? What shall I do? I shall rush out as I am and walk the street with my hair down so. What shall we do tomorrow? What shall we ever do? It's good, right? See, and it incorporates that sing-song quality. It incorporates elements of conversation that we get in Mozart's operas. There are snippets of opera in here. And that Shakespearean rag. It's like the Java Jive, right? I love coffee. I love tea. It loves me. All of that stuff. It's incorporated into this catch-all of fantastic doomsday but oddly uplifting modernism.
And like the best art, it grabs you and hits you on several different levels. I remember reading this vividly as a high school student for the very first time, and it was like right upside the head with a baseball bat. Well, this is not the poetry I've been reading about and told about in the first, oh, I don't know, 9 to 10 years of my education. This is something completely different.
It's the conversational aspect. Like, for instance, a similar poem that predates this one, The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock. I remember reading the lines when I was whatever age you are when you first were assigned something like that, before I was seeking it out on my own, which I then did ravenously after. I grow old, I shall wear the bottoms of my trousers rolled. Now, that's because it's funny, in a way, because when you're old, this is happening to me, you shrink. And so you don't want to part with your pants. I mean, it's also a really macabre joke, because you don't want new pants, because, well, the reapers are coming. So it's like, yeah, you know what? Like, I'm good with these pants. And so that's a hell of a way, if you're thinking that way, really, at any age, to be honest with you. But it's that sing-song, conversational quality. Like, when Mozart was writing his operas, the reason he was doing all these things that were wonderful harmonically. But he also had people just start talking in them. That was crazy. That was like Mozart, the modernist. And that's what you get with Eliot. Like, he has other poems where he's working in bits from the Conan Doyle Sherlock Holmes stories, because he loved that stuff. Dylan loved that stuff. Dylan loved Ovid, But Dylan also liked The Rifleman, right? Things of that nature. And when you just say, oh, you know what? I need to be fancy. I'm only going to be into this John Singer Sargent and not this Norman Rockwell. Well, you're missing that there's a lot of important overlap there, and you're missing out on a lot of things because of your closed-minded attitude. And this was a big melange of stuff that was a directive to keep that mind open, or else you're going to contribute to this sad and tragic wasteland.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. I want to wrap it by talking about a piece that you've written about Samuel Pepys and his diary of the plague year. What draws you to this writing that on the outset doesn't seem all that uplifting until you realize that he viewed the plague as an opportunity?
Yeah, he was into it. And so he was in London in 1665, and he was writing his famous diary. He kept it for about a decade. I already think my blog is longer than his 10 years worth of diaries. And I've read all of them. I love them. It was one of the things that I had in mind when I started the blog. And it was also, frankly, he was a guy I wanted to compete with. People look at his diaries and they say, oh, these are these all-time works of diaristic writing. And I thought, oh, I could do better than that. But I really liked the diary. And so he couldn't stay away from the highest point of the curve. It moved this plague in his time like this pandemic does in ours, from east to west. And you could kind of chart it coming. And he's going to the coffee houses, and he's like, oh, wow, is it coming? Is it almost here? Like, he's sort of into it. And people avoided getting this plague at the time. It was very much a class issue, by going to their baronial manor house somewhere outside of London, or being in prison, like the Earl of Rochester, who was always, like, sodomizing somebody and ending up in the Tower of London, which saved his life. But Pepys is saying, like, okay, honey, to his wife each morning, and he's, like, riding a horse into London to hang out. And he's going, like, he's really grim. He's going to the plague pit. He's like, oh, look at all those bodies. Kind of, like, wells this whole thing from the stranger, but obviously we're not, in this case, dealing with the extermination of a people. We're dealing with this flea-borne disease. But he's boasting. He's like, you know what? Please don't dig me. They like to bite other people. And somehow this guy doesn't get the plague. And he learns a lot about people that I feel like, independently, I've learned about people or had reinforced about people during this pandemic. He realizes he becomes less scared because the ultimate source, the ultimate scourge, isn't what's happening to you bodily. It's kind of the fear, and it's people's inability to be with themselves, and it's mental health issues and things of that nature that are taking the longest toll, ultimately, the generational toll through subsequent generations that he's observing. And he thinks it's important for him, and it was, to write about it. And he writes about it in this really clear-eyed, sometimes chipper, other times incredibly depressing blend of style.
And you obviously learned from him with your blog and the whole idea that as long as it's truth, it has a place.
He was a bigger dick than I am. He had a nice wife. I don't have that yet, but he'd be like, ah, my wife has a fat ass. I'm really not enjoying her. I'm going to go out with one of my mistresses. And like, look, if I ever get to that point, or have the wife, she's going to be hot. But if I ever get to that point, I don't think I would be on the blog writing about some of my, he loved the young ladies, the fillies, as he called them. He was really into, I mean, this, I don't know how, like, the park, I don't know how things didn't get this guy, but he was like the head of this portion of the Navy, and I don't know, he had this constitution, like you, dropping your towel, naked, staring out into the main night, and I feel like the three of us represent the kind of trinity.
I also would have stood there and said at the time, the fleas don't like the taste of me.
Actually, the other day I was flossing my teeth in the shower, and you'll love this. I shouldn't tell anyone this, but I floss in the shower. I'm a hardcore flosser because it correlates with heart health. So I somehow pinch off the floss around my finger, and I get like the portion that's loose, like wrapped in there. There's a little bit hanging out. So I pull it to free it, and it makes it tighter. So I pull it harder, pull it like five more times. Now it is completely cutting off the circulation.
Oh.
It's so deep into the flesh, there's no way to get it out. I'm thinking, I am going to be on Boston.com the severing the tip of my own finger during a time of pain. I leap out, and I just start going at myself with my teeth. I thought, Jesus, you have a heart attack right now. It comes to this. What are people going to think of you? Is that the way you want to go?
No, no. And an interesting end, but it didn't happen that way, and we're all the richer for that. So be careful with that, Floss. And, well, we'll catch up with you again next Tuesday if that works for you.
All right, my friend.
Thank you, Colin. Colin Fleming, check out his work, colinflemminglit.com. Subscribe to the Many Moments More blog as well. You'll be glad you did.